The following program, Confronting Nuclear Proliferation, deals with what is probably the greatest threat to our security, the continued spread of nuclear weapons. Our program features two talks which were given at a symposium sponsored by the Dane County Chapter of the United Nations Association of the USA, held in Madison, Wisconsin on March 4, 2006. We conclude with comments by the Mayor of Madison. The main speaker is Stephen Schwartz, an expert on nuclear weapons and their proliferation. For 6 years, he was executive director and publisher of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, the preeminent journal on the continuing danger from nuclear weapons and the peaceful uses of nuclear technology. The title of his talk is Nuclear Hypocrisy and the Perils of Proliferation. Stephen Schwartz.
Once upon a time, not so long ago, nuclear weapons were widely considered to be unusable. Even proponents of nuclear deterrence, commonly and correctly referred to as the balance of terror, had no real desire to unleash the power of the atom. In the grand paradox of the Cold War, the very existence of nuclear weapons and the threat to use them en masse served to prevent their use. This is not to say, however, that there was no preparation or thought given to using nuclear weapons over the past 6 decades. To the contrary, a significant amount of war planning was done in the United States and the Soviet Union, and now Russia, and presumably in Britain, France, China, and Israel. Scenarios were devised and refined, war games were run and rerun, targets were identified, and vast databases assembled to prepare for the use of the ultimate weapon. During every major conflict following World War II, the United States and perhaps Russia gave serious consideration to using nuclear weapons to defend its interests. Then there were the accidents and close calls when the weapons and systems we so carefully designed to protect us nearly ended up hastening our demise. Most of us are familiar with the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, rightly said to be the closest we've come to nuclear war, but how many remember or even know about the incident during the Suez Crisis in 1956. That's when the U.S. military received 4 separate indications that Soviet forces might be preparing to intervene on Egypt's side against British and French forces, which in the heat of the moment could have triggered the activation of NATO's nuclear strike plans against the Soviet Union. Fortunately, further investigation revealed that each indication had a completely innocent explanation, including that a fleet of unidentified aircraft flying over Turkey was, in fact, a flock of swans. Nor were such incidents confined to the Cold War. Early one morning in January 1995, Norway and the United States jointly launched a 4-stage rocket to study the Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights, from an island off Norway's coast. As it rose above the horizon, the rocket was picked up by Russian early warning radars, which duly alerted a command center in Moscow. President Boris Yeltsin and his defense minister were both notified, and for the first time, Yeltsin's nuclear launch authorization briefcase, similar to the one nicknamed the football that accompanies the U.S. president everywhere he goes, was activated. For 5 or 6 tense minutes, confusion reigned as officials attempted to gather additional information and presumably consider ordering a retaliatory response. The Norwegian Foreign Ministry had sent a routine notification to Russia and 34 other countries in advance of the launch. But for reasons unknown, this notification never reached the on-duty officers manning and overseeing the early warning system. Thus, the research rocket was mistaken for a U.S. Trident II submarine launch missile, which made the threat of greater concern because such missiles, when launched close to Russia, can reach their targets in as little as 5 minutes. Thankfully, the nuclear button was not pushed that day. After a few more minutes, beyond the time in which Moscow could have been destroyed had the attack been real, it was clear that the trajectory of the rocket was north, away from Russia. Another crisis was averted. But now, more than 15 years after the end of the Cold War, when many people wrongly assumed that the nuclear threat had dissipated, nuclear weapons are back on our minds and on the front pages. And instead of worrying about an accidental nuclear war, we find ourselves pondering the possibility that nuclear weapons might be used deliberately by a nation or a terrorist organization. Although such use would be confined to one or perhaps several weapons and thus hardly come close to the massive worldwide devastation once possible during the Cold War, government officials and ordinary citizens alike believe that this threat is more likely, partly because terrorists seem less rational and are not bound by nuclear deterrence, and partly because it's easier to envision an attack with one weapon than an attack with many. Ask most people today what country presents the greatest nuclear threat, and the response is likely to be Iran. Our government, the news media, and many policy experts have drummed this into us. Is this true, and if so, what can be done about it? Iran does represent a threat, and we are in the midst of a crisis. But it is not a crisis about the nuclear bomb. It is a crisis about the nuclear nonproliferation regime, the international network of treaties and obligations that for more than 35 years has successfully prevented the spread of nuclear weapons. As a party to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, or NPT, Iran insists that it has the right to develop nuclear power technology for civilian purposes. And parties to the NPT do indeed have the right to nuclear power for non-military projects. But with that right comes the obligation to operate under the rules of the treaty. And Iran's illegal importation of gas centrifuge technology from the clandestine network operated by Pakistani scientist AQ Khan, its unwillingness to allow routine monitoring and inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency, and its decision in January to remove the IAEA's seals from its test centrifuge equipment, its on-again, off-again negotiations with Russia to abandon uranium enrichment activities in Iran and instead pursue this jointly and under appropriate safeguards at a facility in Russia, and its overheated rhetoric regarding Israel have all created serious suspicions about Iran's true intentions. My own best guess, and it's one shared by many of my colleagues in the arms control community, is that Iran is seeking to acquire at least the capability to produce nuclear weapons, but that no decision to do so has yet been made. In any case, Iran is at best, 5 to 10 years away from being able to build a nuclear weapon. And that assumes that it goes all out and encounters no serious technical obstacles along the way. At this point, Iran has only 164 test centrifuges, known as a cascade, machines which exploit the small differences in the atomic weights of different isotopes of uranium to enrich it to the level needed for use in a nuclear bomb. These were obtained from Pakistan and are currently part of a pilot enrichment facility in Natanz. The centrifuges have not operated flawlessly, and so Iran is some time away from being able to scale up its enrichment operations. Iran has indicated it intends to start industrial operations soon at its underground fuel enrichment plant. Its plans call for installing some 50,000 cascades in modules of 3,000. Should Iran pursue these plans instead of reaching agreement with Russia to conduct joint enrichment operations there, it could eventually produce approximately 500 kilograms of highly enriched uranium annually, or enough for about 25 to 30 weapons a year. Smaller-scale operations are also possible. Just 1,500 centrifuges optimized to produce HEU could generate enough for about one weapon a year. An Iranian bomb does not yet exist. Neither is it inevitable. For the time being, our efforts must focus on how to stop Iran from going nuclear, not on how best to deter it if it does. The key to success is in correctly understanding the Iranian government's motivations and being willing to engage with Iran and reach a negotiated diplomatic settlement. Countries seek nuclear weapons for various reasons. In Iran's case, there are at least three. First, Iran clearly views Israel as a threat. Israel has an unacknowledged arsenal of 75 to 200 nuclear weapons, deliverable by aircraft, ballistic missile, and long-range cruise missile. Iran's leaders may view the acquisition of nuclear weapons as a means to deter Israel. It is possible that some may also seek the destruction of Israel. But any serious move in that direction would almost certainly result in attacks on Iran by Israel and perhaps the United States, factors that would weigh heavily in rational minds. Second, Iran may seek to deter or threaten the United States. The United States government, after all, has made no secret of its distaste for Iran's theocratic regime. 4 years ago, President Bush nominated Iran as a charter member of his Axis of Evil. And with more than 130,000 U.S. troops operating across the border in Iraq, and senior U.S. officials having openly talked in 2003 of taking on Iran after overthrowing Saddam Hussein's government, the Iranian leadership has reason to be concerned about U.S. intentions. Third, as with India's development of nuclear weapons, there is an element of prestige and national pride at work here. But despite the various logical reasons why Iran might want to obtain nuclear weapons, and I want to make clear that I'm not at all condoning what Iran is doing, or why it might want to provoke a fight with the West, many observers, including what I suspect is a large number of people in the United States, find Iran's motivations to be irrational, in a word, crazy. This was exemplified by an editorial cartoon that ran in the Chicago Tribune and other newspapers last month. Some of you may have seen it. The cartoon by Doug Marlette features a maniacal-looking, bearded Semitic man labeled Iran, holding a butterfly net and chasing the symbol of atomic energy, which in this context seems to refer to nuclear weapons. Running right behind him, carrying a bigger net, is an angry-looking white man whose identification tag reads Bellevue Mental Hospital. The not-so-subtle message is that Iran is literally crazy for seeking nuclear weapons. Would, I wonder, the Tribune have published the cartoon if the crazy man were labeled Israel, to pick another country just at random from the region? To digress for just a moment, there are 8 countries that have nuclear weapons: the United States, Russia, Britain, France, China, India, Israel, and Pakistan. 2 of them, the United States and Russia, together possess nearly 26,000 nuclear weapons, 95% of the world's total. More than 15 years after the end of the Cold War, some 11,500 of these weapons remain operational and on active alert, ready to be fired within minutes at their pre-programmed targets. To put this in some perspective, if the firepower contained in just the operational U.S. nuclear stockpile could somehow be segregated into Hiroshima-sized weapons, the U.S. arsenal would consist of 91,500 Hiroshima-sized bombs. If these weapons were then exploded at the rate of 1 each minute, it would take 2 months, or 63.6 days to be precise, to use up the entire U.S. stockpile. Moreover, the fiscal 2007 budget submitted to Congress last month makes clear the Bush administration is seeking the down payment on a controversial and very expensive plan to resume production of new nuclear weapons, with the goal of rebuilding the entire U.S. arsenal by 2030. How crazy is that? Iran can also now look to India as an example of how to break the rules and get away with it. After India conducted a series of provocative underground nuclear weapons tests nearly 8 years ago, 24 years after India first demonstrated a nuclear weapons capability, the Clinton administration imposed sanctions on India and on Pakistan, which responded with a test series of its own. These sanctions were short-lived, however, even as India refused to negotiate away its arsenal, which, like Pakistan's and Israel's, exists outside the legal framework of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Just 2 days ago, President Bush rewarded India, as well as the U.S. nuclear power industry, with a deal that tacitly accepts India's nuclear arsenal and grants it unprecedented access to nuclear technology, access that, by the way, is currently illegal, which will enable it to build even more weapons. Iranians may well be thinking to themselves, if we are patient and we play our cards right and make ourselves a valuable ally of the United States, this could be us in a decade or so. This is, to put it mildly, not a helpful message to be sending when our paramount objective should be preventing the further spread or misuse of nuclear weapons and nuclear technology. Not so long ago, nuclear weapons were considered inherently dangerous no matter who controlled them. U.S. policy concentrated on limiting the spread of such weapons regardless of who sought them. With the advent of the Bush administration, the approach has changed. Now the emphasis is on regime change to prevent nuclear weapons from falling into the wrong hands. Among the many problems with this approach is that the bad guys and the good guys can switch places with a change in government leadership. Pakistan is case in point. For more than 20 years, successive U.S. administrations have turned a blind eye to Pakistan's nuclear weapons program, first because it was an ally against the Soviet Union following the invasion of neighboring Afghanistan, and then, after 2001, because it supported U.S. efforts to overthrow the Taliban and oust al-Qaeda. During this period, there have been 2 military coups, and more recently, Islamic extremists have targeted President Pervez Musharraf for assassination, which he has narrowly escaped at least twice. Pakistan's government may be friendly now, but what happens if Islamic extremists take over? At the very least, a lot of people will be asking why we didn't do more to eliminate Pakistan's arsenal while it was still possible. Another problem with the Bush administration's approach to nuclear nonproliferation is its disdain and even contempt for international law and diplomacy. While pledging not to resume nuclear weapons testing, the administration refuses to push for ratification of the 1996 Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, a key means of preventing the spread of nuclear weapons. It has also reduced and even tried to eliminate funding for a worldwide network of sensors to operate under the treaty and detect nuclear explosions, even extremely small ones, in the atmosphere, underground, or underwater. And we must not forget that the administration also actively impeded and denigrated the work of the International Atomic Energy Agency in the months and weeks before attacking Iraq. We now know, of course, that the IAEA inspectors were right about the complete lack of any nuclear weapons or even an active weapons development program in Iraq, something that they could have proved had they been allowed to complete their work. The irony is that what led to the discovery and dismantlement of Iraq's nuclear program in the first place was the inspection regime put in place after the first Gulf War in 1991. Most troubling of all, the administration has reneged on the commitments made by the Clinton administration to honor the letter and spirit of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty by working to further reduce and eventually eliminate the U.S. nuclear arsenal. At its most recent review of the landmark treaty in 2005 at the United Nations, the Bush administration disavowed this commitment and, even worse, undermined the ability of the delegates to achieve consensus on anything of significance. The primary reason we have just 8 nuclear-armed states instead of the 15 or 20 that President Kennedy, speculating in the early 1960s, worried might exist by 1975, is the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. That agreement convinced countries that might have gone nuclear to abstain by offering them incentives and by committing the then 5 nuclear nations to, quote, pursue negotiations in good faith on effective measures relating to the cessation of the nuclear arms race at an early date and to nuclear disarmament, unquote. And while the arms race is clearly over and the number of weapons worldwide has decreased by nearly 60%, or more than 38,000, that still leaves more than 26,000 weapons. And for most people, that's 26,000 too many. The more than 180 non-nuclear signatories to the NPT have been patient, but it is clear they will not wait indefinitely for the nuclear powers to fulfill their obligations. In lieu of diplomacy and the rule of law, the administration in 2001 and 2002 implemented a series of policies and directives aimed at using coercion and military force to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons. This is known as counterproliferation. Not surprisingly, the military takes the lead in this effort. There are many problems with relying on counterproliferation rather than nonproliferation. For one, the focus tends to be on eliminating weapons or weapons programs rather than preventing their acquisition in the first place. But the biggest problem today with the U.S. approach is that the administration has very little credibility on this issue. By initiating a preventative war with Iraq 3 years ago this month, on the pretext that it was or would imminently become a nuclear threat, only to subsequently discover that no such threat existed, the administration has made it significantly harder to go after countries that are known and were known in a less ambiguous way before the war to represent bigger proliferation threats. Now, when the administration starts proffering the same arguments against Iran that it made against Iraq, the international community is skeptical. It is also wary of once again using the United Nations as a staging ground for another preventive war, even one that might be more limited. The United States undercuts its own arguments in other ways. The Bush administration's Nuclear Posture Review, or NPR, completed in late 2001, requires, quote, nuclear strike capabilities, unquote, for, quote, immediate potential or unexpected contingencies, unquote, involving North Korea, Iran, Syria, Libya, Russia, and China, which was dropped from nuclear war plans in the 1980s during the Reagan administration. Immediate nuclear contingencies include, quote, a North Korean attack on South Korea or a military confrontation over the status of Taiwan, unquote. The Nuclear Posture Review also calls for developing deliberate, pre-planned, and practiced missions to attack an adversary's weapons of mass destruction facilities preemptively or in response to an attack on the United States or its allies. And it promotes the rebuilding of the nuclear weapons production complex, largely shuttered since the early 1990s, and the development of new nuclear weapons to support such planning. Such new weapons include the robust nuclear earth penetrator, a high-yield weapon concept intended to hold at risk and destroy hardened underground targets such as arms bunkers or command and control installations without causing significant damage, including radioactive fallout, on the surface. Addressing what's wrong with this concept would require more time than I have today, so suffice it to say that such a weapon is physically impossible. It is a fantasy dreamed up by people desperate to find new uses for increasingly irrelevant weapons, people who want to make the use of nuclear weapons more palatable, more politically acceptable, by, in effect, neutering them, taking away the very qualities that make them what they are. Congress has terminated this program as unnecessary and incompatible with U.S. policy, but it may yet reappear, perhaps in the future when the political climate is more favorable, perhaps under a different name. More troubling is the Reliable Replacement Warhead Program. This project is based on the false premise that U.S. warheads will only grow more unreliable over time and that they therefore must be replaced if nuclear deterrence is to remain effective. Supporters of this program also argue that it is simply too expensive to maintain 12 different warhead types in the existing stockpile. Developing a standardized, simpler, more rugged warhead design, they say, will reduce production and maintenance costs and improve reliability. Originally proposed by Congress in late 2004, the Reliable Replacement Warhead is now part of a broader effort initiated within the Department of Energy, which is responsible for the development, production, testing, and dismantlement of U.S. nuclear weapons, to reconfigure the entire nuclear weapons complex, which last built new warheads in 1990 and last tested them in 1992. This effort is very roughly estimated to cost at least $150 billion over the next 24 years. In December 2002, the administration released the National Strategy to Combat Weapons of Mass Destruction in unclassified form. It was based on classified National Security Presidential Directive 17, signed by President Bush in May 2002. This document builds on the Nuclear Posture Review and on the administration's National Security Strategy for the United States, which was released in September of that year. Signaling an expansion of the administration's preventive preemptive war doctrine, the document declares, quote, "We must be prepared to stop rogue states and their terrorist clients before they are able to threaten or use weapons of mass destruction against the United States and our allies and friends," unquote. It continues, quote, "Given the goals of rogue states and terrorists, the United States can no longer solely rely on a reactive posture as we have in the past. We cannot let our enemies strike first," unquote. But the document goes further still in marrying a preventive preemptive strategy with nuclear weapons. And here's an extended quote. "Today's threats are far more diverse and less predictable than those of the past. As a consequence, we require new methods of deterrence. The United States will continue to make clear that it reserves the right to respond with overwhelming force, including potentially nuclear weapons, to the use of WMD against the United States, our forces abroad, and our friends and allies. Because deterrence may not succeed, and because of the potentially devastating consequences of WMD use, U.S. military forces and appropriate civilian agencies must have the capability to defend against WMD-armed adversaries, including in appropriate cases through preemptive measures. This requires capabilities to detect and destroy an adversary's WMD assets before these weapons are used," unquote. A top-secret appendix, which understandably was not released, authorizes attacks on Iran, Syria, North Korea, and other countries believed to be close to acquiring weapons of mass destruction or long-range missiles capable of delivering them. Attacks would be ordered to prevent the use of WMD or the transfer of WMD or WMD components into or out of such countries. Now, put yourself in the shoes of Iran, North Korea, China, or even Russia. How would you respond to a country that pledges allegiance to the concept of nuclear nonproliferation, but which shows no interest in verifiably dismantling its stockpile of 10,000 warheads and bombs, 5,300 of which remain operational, continues to maintain some 2,500 warheads on quick launch alert, ready for firing within minutes of receiving a launch order, publicly promulgates a strategy for preemptive nuclear attack and even identifies possible target countries, initiates plans to rebuild its nuclear weapons factories for the express purpose of churning out new warheads well into the 21st century, modernizes its warheads and delivery systems to increase their accuracy and effectiveness against hardened targets, something that only makes sense if the weapons are to be launched first, and is building a missile defense system, which clearly has no current or even prospective capability to defeat an attack of anything more than a handful of ballistic missiles, if that, but which could prove quite useful in mopping up an adversary's ragtag response to a U.S. first strike. If you are and wish to remain a sovereign nation, you will retain what nuclear weapons you have, or lacking any, you will seek to acquire them as quickly as possible to deter the United States from attacking you. And this is, of course, what is happening. This is not to say that U.S. actions and policies are an excuse or the sole justification for the actions of other countries. But it is clear that U.S. policies and programs are exacerbating rather than ameliorating today's dangerous trends in nuclear proliferation. But it's not just the so-called rogue states that are responding. China is considering options for augmenting its arsenal. And in the wake of the agreement with India, which will allow them to build more nuclear weapons, I'm sure they're considering that even more seriously now. Russia, hearkening back to its earlier existence as the Soviet Union, has increased its reliance on nuclear weapons, touted the development of a maneuvering warhead to defeat any U.S. defensive system, and is preparing later this year to roll out a new mobile ICBM. And in mid-January, French President Jacques Chirac announced that henceforth, France's nuclear arsenal would protect not only France itself, but also serve to guarantee certain strategic supplies necessary to the functioning of the nation. French analysts, among others, have interpreted this to mean oil, and specifically oil from Iran. But it's not all bad news. There are now fewer operational nuclear weapons worldwide than at any time since 1958. Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan all were persuaded to return to Russia the nuclear weapons they inherited after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Libya has recently abandoned its interest in developing nuclear weapons. No nation has tested nuclear weapons since 1998, despite the fact that the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty has not yet entered into force. Meanwhile, the treaty's network of sensors continues to grow in capability each year. Today, more than half of the Earth has been declared a nuclear weapons-free zone by one treaty or another, including much of the Southern Hemisphere. And Congress, after a prolonged period of somnolence and excessive deference to the executive branch, is finally exercising its constitutional authority on nuclear matters, including canceling the robust nuclear Earth penetrator, questioning the reliable replacement warhead, and raising strong objections to the just-signed U.S.-India nuclear trade agreement. So what can be done? When it comes to Iran, there are really no good choices. The key now is to unite the international community behind an effort to persuade the Iranian government that its actions are unacceptable and will not be tolerated, and that serious penalties will accrue if it continues down this path. At the same time, the international community must demonstrate that important benefits will come its way if Iran remains within the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and abandons its current uranium enrichment plans. Agreeing to Russia's proposal to host a joint uranium enrichment facility on Russian soil would be a welcome first step in that direction. Subsequent steps will obviously depend on what Iran does next, but among the options under consideration are economic and political sanctions and military attack. There's insufficient time this morning to go into all possible permutations, but the key thing to keep in mind with sanctions is that they will only be effective if they are imposed by the United Nations and not individual countries. The UN Security Council cannot allow Iran to evade its obligations under the NPT. If it does, the legitimacy and future effectiveness of that treaty will be in serious jeopardy. As for a military attack, notwithstanding all the recent news stories based on leaks or informed speculation from the United States and Israel, at least some of which seem designed to pressure Iran into modifying its behavior, it's important to understand that targeted strikes against Iran's nuclear infrastructure would only delay its program, not destroy it. The facilities are too widely dispersed, many are buried underground, and some are probably still unknown to military targeters. And a campaign of massive and sustained bombardment would seem to be out of the question. The model for such an attack is the Israeli strike against Iraq's Osirak reactor in 1981, at a time when Iraq was pursuing the use of plutonium for nuclear weapons. The attack did destroy the reactor before it became operational, but it was not the success it was believed to be at the time or even today, because after the attack, Saddam Hussein switched to the use of highly enriched uranium and directed that the program go underground and be carried out covertly. So successful was this approach that it was only after the first Gulf War that international inspectors discovered just how ambitious the program was and how close Iraq had come to developing a bomb. Moreover, an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities would be seen inside Iran and by the Muslim world in general as an attack on a sovereign state, rallying the Iranian people and much of the Muslim world against the attackers. Before seriously considering such an option, it is essential to consider how Iran would respond to the attack and how we would respond to their response. If the answers to these questions don't show things getting better following the attack, it's time to try another approach. Then there's the effort by the United States, announced recently by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, to spend $75 million to promote internal opposition to Iran's existing government. Apart from the irony that the world's self-appointed promoter of democracy would support, much less publicly announce, an effort to destabilize a democratically elected government, this paltry program seems doomed to failure because it will most likely delegitimize and thus hamper internal Iranian dissent, while at the same time providing the Iranian government ample reason to harden its position and accelerate its nuclear program. A better use of the State Department's time and money, our money really, would be to use the United Nations to rally the world behind the cause of nonproliferation, demonstrating that this is not just a regional problem, but a global one. Then we could lead the way to strengthening the NPT, starting with renewing our commitment to nuclear disarmament, and then moving on to close the loopholes in the treaty that allow parties to legally acquire everything necessary to produce nuclear weapons, and then withdraw with no penalty from the treaty to develop such weapons free from the treaty's restrictions. We should also abandon counterproliferation as our primary means of combating the spread of nuclear weapons and nuclear technology. Taking nonproliferation seriously means expanding and fully funding efforts like the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, which since the early 1990s has helped Russia to secure sizable quantities of nuclear weapons materials and destroy nuclear delivery systems like ICBMs, bomber aircraft, and submarines, not to mention sealing up all of their nuclear test holes at their Kazakhstan nuclear test site. Yet an influential 2004 Harvard study found less progress in this program in the years following 9/11 than in the years preceding it. The government should also heed the recommendations of a bipartisan 2001 task force, which recommended spending $30 billion over 10 years, or $3 billion a year, to eradicate the threat posed by unsecured or poorly secured nuclear weapons and weapons materials. Yet 5 years later, annual spending continues to be just over $1 billion. Contrast that with the almost $10 billion we're going to spend on missile defense this year. The United States should also work with Israel and the other nations of the Middle East to establish a nuclear weapon-free zone in the region. This is clearly a long-term objective, but even agreeing to it as an objective and beginning negotiations toward that end could go a long way toward resolving some of the current dilemmas. As part of this process, Israel would have to acknowledge the existence of its nuclear stockpile. The American people and the Congress which represents them must demand a reversal of the Bush administration's failed and inconsistent approach to nuclear proliferation. We cannot pick and choose whose nuclear weapons are tolerable and whose are not and expect any degree of success or safety. Neither can we have a successful policy by confronting proliferation one country at a time. We need a policy that treats countries equally and fairly. Lastly, as the undisputed sole superpower and the only country ever to use nuclear weapons, the United States has a unique responsibility when it comes to nuclear nonproliferation. We also have more to lose if the nonproliferation regime collapses or is allowed to deteriorate to such a point that it becomes meaningless. Simply put, we must lead by example. If we, with our vastly superior conventional capabilities and inherent geographic advantages, insist on retaining and modernizing the nuclear arsenal well into the 21st century and using it, among other things, to target those countries that would challenge us, other countries will naturally respond in kind. When combined with a systematic effort to devalue international agreements that constrain the spread of nuclear weapons, this is a recipe for nuclear disaster. If, on the other hand, we abandon our six-decade embrace of the bomb, devalue nuclear weapons as instruments of military and diplomatic policy, and demonstrate that such weapons actually contribute to instability and insecurity, we will be doing ourselves and the world a tremendous favor. Thank you.
The second speaker is Stephen Leeper, United States Representative of Mayors for Peace, a United Nations accredited non-governmental organization. He speaks on how cities are pressing the United Nations to get moving on nuclear disarmament. Now, Stephen Leeper.
The World Conference of Mayors for Peace launched an emergency campaign to ban nuclear weapons in 2003. This kind of movement that we saw within the American administration trying to really think about nuclear weapons as a combat weapon. They're talking about them as combat weapons now. That is the thing that really frightened Hiroshima. Another thing that really frightened Hiroshima, of course, was India and Pakistan going nuclear. And the reason that frightened them is because both of those countries went nuclear basically for internal political reasons. It was useful to the political parties that got those weapons to have those weapons to help keep them in power. And so what we see right now is the human family is making a very, very important decision. Whether we are going to get rid of all nuclear weapons or whether just about everybody is going to have one. Because if we keep on going on the track we're going on now, it is going to be fashionable and important for any strong man, for any government anywhere, to have nuclear weapons. And if they don't have nuclear weapons, they'll be criticized internally for not having them. So they need them. They're even talking about having them in Japan now because of this whole thing about how dangerous North Korea is. And we are moving in an extremely dangerous direction. And so the Mayors for Peace, which was founded in 1982 and took approximately 22 years to get its first 464 members, went from 464 to now we have over 1,300 members in just these last 2.5 years. The vast majority of those members are coming from Europe. In Europe, people are very excited about this whole nuclear thing because they've been living under this threat a lot more directly and a lot longer than we have. They want them gone. They want all the nukes out of Europe, and you will be soon seeing, I think, a very strong movement in that direction. But right now, I would like to direct your attention to the United Nations. It's very popular in left-wing crowds. Even in Hiroshima, there are a lot of left-wing peace people who are not at all impressed with the United Nations. They don't want to talk about the United Nations. They consider it a paper tiger or some kind of useless thing, and what we really need to do is defeat Bush in the U.S. or make changes nationally. But the Mayors for Peace believes wholeheartedly that another important decision that the human family is making right now is whether we are going to be ruled by naked, raw, violent power, or whether we are going to be ruled by the rule of law. And the only alternative we have to the situation now, which is the United States setting itself up as the boss of the world, rewarding its friends and punishing its enemies, the only alternative we have is the United Nations. The United Nations is the place where you get together, you talk about things, you make rules, you make treaties, and you try to decide in a civilized way how to proceed. So we have to support the United Nations. For the first 2 years of our campaign, we focused on the NPT. A lot of people criticize us for that. The NPT is worthless. It's a discriminating, terrible treaty, et cetera, et cetera. But we proceeded with that because we have to support the UN. Now, the NPT, you know, as we knew, as everybody knew, the NPT review conference in May ended up with not doing anything at all. So we have now to do something. What are we going to do? A lot of people began talking immediately about abandoning the UN again. But what we are doing is lobbying within the UN to get something new to happen. And I am here now bringing you some very good news. I think something is going to happen in the UN, and it's going to happen probably this year or early next year. But we have an international campaign manager in Geneva now working very closely with a number of countries. And the countries, the national delegates, the ambassadors to the UN, at that level, people know the danger that we're facing. They know that we are deciding to get rid of nuclear weapons or to have everybody have one. And they are determined to stop this. And what they are talking about now is a thing called consensus abuse. Consensus abuse is what's been going on for the last at least 8 years, since the Conference on Disarmament in Geneva was set up. We have the MPT, which is the central agreement about nuclear weapons. Then we have the Conference on Disarmament, where we are obligated under the MPT to negotiate in good faith to eliminate our nuclear arsenals. Well, that has not been happening because of consensus abuse. Both of those organizations are under the consensus rule. That means the agenda, the work program, every word of every report or recommendation that comes out of there has to be agreed by everyone. So it's very easy for certain countries to stop progress on that. So what we are doing now is we are confronting consensus abuse. And in the first committee last October, we got six nations to make a proposal. This proposal would have established four working groups. Those four working groups would have deliberated and set up some kind of a procedure for negotiating about four different aspects of disarmament. The result of that, just presenting this proposal, elicited a very, very intense opposition from the United States. They did what they call demarching, which is not negotiating within the UN framework, but they went to the next level up, the foreign minister or State Department level, so that then our State Department contacted foreign ministers and said, you have to stop this. We expect you to stop this. They especially worked hard on Canada, which was one of our countries doing this, because Canada is a member of NATO. So the six countries that were making that proposal chickened out for this year. I don't blame them, really. They hadn't done enough of the background organizing of support to get this thing through. So they said, okay, we are not going to submit this as a resolution this year, but we are going to watch the Conference on Disarmament very carefully, and if it's not making progress this year, we are going to do it next year. So we think that something is going to happen, possibly in April. April 10 to 28 is the UN Disarmament Commission. That is an organization that has, for the last 3 years, sort of habitually made decisions by consensus, but it does not have to. It can go for a vote, and if the agenda is not set on the first day, April 10, Mexico is going to demand a vote. They've already promised to do that. Then there will be some discussion in the UN Disarmament Commission. Then there will be more activity in the Conference on Disarmament in Geneva, and then there will be the first committee. Somewhere along the line, we are going to get a vote. That vote is going to set up these working committees or working groups, and these will begin to make a roadmap to nuclear disarmament. What we're calling for is a framework agreement. Like the Kyoto Protocol, for example, is a framework agreement. A framework agreement just sets up sort of the pattern, how we are going to negotiate, how we are going to approach the problems. What are the various problems that have to be solved? So we are going to establish this framework agreement, and that framework agreement will then be presented to the first committee, or the General Assembly, and there it will be approved by a vast majority. Every year in the first committee, for example, this year, you know, Japan makes its annual resolution to eliminate nuclear weapons. It's a very weak one, doesn't say when we're going to do it or anything. And every year it passes by 177-2. This year it was 166-2. The two are always India and the United States. But we will have a vast majority that will pass this effort to make a framework agreement. When we get that framework agreement underway, the United States is going to have to veto it. or block it in some very obvious way. They're going to have to step out and make a very clear blocking thing. Right now, it's not clear. You know, all of this consensus stuff makes it all very hazy and fuzzy. Nobody knows exactly what's going on. Our goal is to make it clear that the whole entire world is trying to get rid of nuclear weapons, and the U.S. is stopping that. At that point, there will be a big movement against the U.S. But the main point that I'm making right here today and ask for your help with is, first of all, we need to have this issue put into public consciousness. We need people aware of this. This is an extremely important issue. And we have to send the message to all governments everywhere that people care about this issue, that we don't want to be annihilated. That is a very important thing to send out right now. Then, the most important thing is we need to prepare so that when the crucial time comes, when the United Nations passes a framework agreement and tries to set up substantive negotiation for nuclear disarmament, then the U.S. stops it. We need a million people in the streets. We had a million people in the streets in 1982 for the second special session on disarmament. That was back when we had all those 50,000 or 70,000 nuclear weapons and we were making more of them, and everybody was afraid that we would all be extinguished. Well, we are not exactly worried about that right now, but we are seriously worried that nuclear weapons are going to be used. If they are used, it's not going to stop with just one. The United States is not going to drop a nuclear bunker buster in Iran, and then that will be the end of all nuclear weapons use. We can guarantee that something is going to come back here. And if some kind of even a small, messy, nasty little terrorist bomb blows up half of Chicago, the United States is going to go ballistic and will use nuclear weapons somewhere. This is the kind of scenario that Hiroshima is terrified of. So we have to prevent this by really launching an effort to get rid of nuclear weapons. And we need to see you caring about this. We need a million people in the streets when this thing happens. Then it will probably happen sometime this year or next year. So get ready.
During the Q&A, a member of the audience said that he does not see, in today's climate, the political will to move toward nuclear disarmament. He asks what can be done to create that will.
I think that's why we want to work with the UN. We think the UN is the best possible alternative that we have. We have to come up with this framework agreement or some kind of substantive negotiations. We have to set up a very clear line of who is trying to get rid of nuclear weapons and who is trying to block that, and then we might be able to get it to be something of interest to people, something that they will follow, something that we can get the news to pick up, the daily nuclear report or something like that. We need to do some things along those lines. And I think the UN is really the place to do it. And we really have the votes there. The vast majority of countries want to do something about nuclear weapons. Even the Republicans are stopping this thing now. So this is an issue that we can win on. And I think this is our best chance of a victory that could help to shift consciousness from the highly competitivist world paradigm that we're on now to a more cooperative one. If we cannot cooperate enough to get rid of something as obvious as a threat to all of our existence, how can we cooperate enough to take care of global warming or do any of the other kind of very difficult cooperative tasks that lie ahead of us?
Madison is one of about 80 U.S. cities that belong to Mayors for Peace. Mayor David Cheslevich spoke in April 2006 about the organization and his involvement with it.
Mayors for Peace was started in the early 1980s by the mayors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. For obvious reasons, the mayors of those communities were very concerned, primarily about nuclear proliferation. And since then, they've been working for nuclear disarmament, and so they created the organization 20 years ago. And since then, it's grown, and now there are over 1,000 cities that are part of Mayors for Peace. In the United States, it's about 100 or so who have joined. So it's a growing movement. And I think it's also important because our national governments are not doing much in terms of trying to turn back nuclear proliferation. There certainly isn't any commitment to it in the Bush administration. And so I think there's an understanding that if we're going to be able to make progress on this issue, it's going to have to come from the grassroots. Every 5 years, the UN conducts a review of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And in 2005, it was one of those years. And so they invited the mayors in as observers and as participants in that process, which goes on for about 6 weeks. The Mayors for Peace Conference was at the very beginning of that. And we were able to actually go see the formal beginning of the review. And then we were visited by Kofi Annan, who spoke with us. So I was able to participate with over 100 mayors from around the world at that meeting. I think the hope was that we would create the impetus for something positive to come out of it. Unfortunately, very little did. The Bush administration, while they continue to criticize, you know, so-called rogue states like North Korea for possibly developing nuclear capability, they fail to live up to our end of the deal, the United States' end of the deal, which is to actually reduce our own nuclear arsenal. And so it's very difficult for the United States to have any moral suasion in the world asking other countries to live up to a pact that we ourselves are not living up to. I've learned quite a bit about the issues related to nuclear proliferation, both in terms of the existing nuclear arsenal that the U.S. and other countries have, and the relatively new prospect of the use of a nuclear weapon by a terrorist organization that could smuggle it into the country. I was surprised to learn that we still maintain a very substantial nuclear arsenal, really not very different than what we had before the end of the Cold War. We're still on the same hair trigger. It still takes about 20 minutes to go to nuclear war, believe it or not. And as a matter of fact, it's routine every day for the Strategic Air Command to pick up something which indicates a potential nuclear attack that we could respond to very quickly. And we still spend a great deal of money on it. That Madisonians spend about $28 million of their tax dollars on maintaining the nuclear arsenal. That's $28 million that could be invested in affordable housing or mass transit projects or rail projects that we're interested in. So many needs in our community could be addressed if we weren't spending those kinds of resources on nuclear arms.
Why should cities get involved with an international issue such as this one?
Good question. Three reasons. First of all, because our national governments are not, especially the United States government, has not lived up to its requirements, its commitments under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. That's part of it. We're not getting any leadership from our federal government. Secondly, as I mentioned earlier, the cost, the tremendous cost of maintaining the nuclear arsenal at a time when our federal government is cutting back on programs like the Community Development Block Grant Program, which funds neighborhood centers and affordable housing and programs for the homeless and economic development. All those things are being cut back at the federal level, and yet they're maintaining a no longer needed nuclear arsenal. And then third, cities are likely to be the targets for any kind of nuclear attack, whether it's something that's smuggled in or something that's delivered through intercontinental ballistic missile. Cities are going to be the target for that. And so those are the three main reasons that I think it's important for mayors of local governments to get involved. And it was good that the last meeting in May of 2005, took place in New York, because there was an opportunity for mayors from the United States, who generally don't have the travel budgets to be able to go overseas. Many of us were able to get there. I think there were about 24 U.S. mayors there. I was a little unhappy, though, and a little surprised that Madison, unfortunately, was one of the largest cities represented. No mayor of New York, no mayor of Chicago, no mayor of Los Angeles. The mayor of Paris was there. The mayor of London was represented. The mayor of Vancouver was there. The mayor of Montreal. And yet the major American cities stayed away, and I think that was unfortunate. I think that perhaps they felt the politics of it was a little too hot. I don't know. I don't know why there's so much awareness of this issue on behalf of major city mayors in other countries, in Europe and Canada and other places, and yet there doesn't seem to be the same level of awareness here among big city mayors. I'm not clear on why that is. But I'm happy to say that mayors are getting involved in other issues that are national and international in nature. For example, the mayor of Seattle has started a movement to combat global warming because he's frustrated with the lack of initiative on behalf of the Bush administration. So mayors are getting involved in a variety of issues. They are taking the lead. Big part of it is just awareness. You know, I was able to come back and speak to a number of different organizations about it, share what I learned. I had a chance to network with some mayors in New York, some of whom I'm still in contact with. Had a very interesting conversation with the representative of the mayor of London, who talked about how very real this is to them since 9/11 and since the U.S. actions after 9/11, which they feel put them in even more peril from terrorist attacks. So it created a sense of awareness for me about these issues that I didn't have before I went, and it's allowed me to bring that awareness back to Madison.
Is your city a member of Mayors for Peace? To find out, go to www.mayorsforpeace.org. The full text of Stephen Schwartz's talk, Nuclear Hypocrisy, can be found at the website of the United Nations Association of Dane County. Audio recordings of this and other thought-provoking programs are available at our website. Go to www.themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the sponsors or of the Madison Institute.